Hi, my name's Michael Coughlin. I'm from University of Colorado Boulder, and I'm here to talk about apps with hardware, how to enable runtime architectural customization in smartphones. So I worked on this with Ali Ismail and Eric Keller, who's my advisor. Ali did part of this for his master's thesis. So basically I want to talk about first is mobile devices and problems that we have. So basically when you're designing a mobile device, your devices are designed around certain restrictions, and these things include energy consumption or form factor. This leads to certain trade-offs, such as smaller power sources, less powerful hardware, and generally you have a bunch of static capabilities in your device. But our question is, what if users or developers could make these decisions instead of the manufacturers? And so with that, we present what our vision is a smartphone that includes an FPGA. And what we would have is an FPGA and just a basic ARM CPU that exists on the same chip on your device, and then applications would include both a hardware and a software component. And what this allows us to do is enables a lot of new application types that you can run on your device that you normally couldn't. For example, to start out with, you can do software-defined radio using an FPGA on your device. Normally these things require specialized hardware like such as the URSRP or other different FPGA-based large chips that you normally can't get on a device. But what the problem is that a lot of research has gone into doing these things at various conferences, but the research that they present can't actually be applied to devices no matter how good it is. So for example, what I could do is, for example, in the field of ultra-high frequency retasking, a lot of research has been done to make it so mobile devices can use other spectrums. But normally I can't do that on a existing device because it requires special hardware. Other things that I could do are things like just high-performance computing tasks. FPGAs are really good at parallelized processing. So things like cryptography or analytics, they have a lot of promise has been shown in using FPGAs to speed these things up. I can do something like that on a smartphone on a smaller scale and achieve a lot higher speed up than I could do even using a GPU accelerator. And finally, there's just things that I can't do normally without an FPGA. For example, things that will be done with, say, a PCI peripheral on a normal computer, I can do this with an FPGA on a mobile device. For example, the Copilot project was a system that used a PCI peripheral to detect rootkits because PCI has direct memory access. Well, the FPGA has this exact same access. Other things I could do were things like the somniloquy work allowed for offloading of computation from the CPU to the FPGA for network processing, allowing you to put the CPU into a lower power state. So now the question is, why is this a good time to do this? And the answer to that is, first, we now have chips that include both ARM CPUs and FPGAs in the same SoC, so they can be a drop-in replacement for existing devices because they use the same architecture, they can run the same operating systems. And we have a new system to allow us to design hardware modules. Instead of using a hardware description language like Verilog, you can use something a little bit higher level using C, which is a lot more accessible, then have this generated into your hardware definition. So there's also a fundamental problem to this of why this hasn't already been done, and that's how to share an FPGA between different applications. So I want to first say what we can already do with existing stuff. So right now we have a processor and an FPGA. If I want to load an app onto this, so I can already do that. This is a system called runtime reconfiguration, and it works to put an application into the processor and to reconfigure the FPGA while it's running, sort of. What we can't do is I can't put an application that I don't know about once I'm designing stuff for the FPGA. So basically what I can't do is if I have two apps, one of these apps I didn't know about, just someone wrote it, I can't put this into the FPGA once the FPGA configuration has already been generated. And if this is a single chip, this really illustrates the problem, is that there's going to be all these connections that have to go through the FPGA to connect various things. Well, some of these can go through my hardware, which is fine if I know about the applications when I'm designing this. I can put the wire through the application and reconfigure it fine. But the problem is these wires, if I don't know about them for some other thing, if I put it into the FPGA, it's very likely that your FPGA is going to crash. So why hasn't this been solved before? There's basically over a decade of research has proposed two main solutions to this. First is called runtime place and route, and the second time is slot-based reconfiguration. And I'm going to go over why both of those are not applicable today, why we still can't use those. So first, runtime place and route. Basically, it assumes that there's some free space in the FPGA. This FPGA doesn't have a whole lot of stuff going on to it. It has some wires and some other things. But I want to place a new module in here somewhere. So if I do that, I can stick it in there. What I would now do is I would run routing to connect all the wires, but this can fail for a number of reasons, part of which is routing is an NP-complete problem. I also have to make sure my wires don't get too long because of propagation delay. And if there's not enough room or if a wire is conflicting, this will fail. And the problem is that routing is also very time-consuming. So if I want to do this on a mobile device, it is going to be very prohibitive because this can take up to hours on a multi-core x86 very high frequency processor. Running on a mobile device is also not practical. So using this solution is not practical for our purposes. The second solution is slot-based reconfiguration. Basically, you reserve identical regions in the FPGA. Then you constrain your tools to not route wires inside of these regions, and then to make sure that all these slots have the same interfaces, the same wires coming in and out of them. So what this allows you to do is you can load your hardware into these slots so long as it maintains the same interface. But the problem is if there is other logic in there, then routing of the wires becomes very constrained. I have to route wires all around stuff, like if my FPGA is something other than slots, which it will be because there need to be interconnects. And this is a problem because if the routing becomes too constrained, the wires become too long, or there's not enough space. It's basically the same problem we had before. So this is also not practical. So in summary, previous research, both runtime, place, and route, is computationally expensive and can fail, and slot-based reconfiguration is still too constrained. So previous research we cannot use. So to solve this, we introduce our system that we call Cloud RTR, with RTR standing for Runtime Reconfiguration. This allows us to share an FPGA between general apps. But we do this using existing vendor technologies. And to do this, we adopt the idea of slots from previous research because it is similar to what existing vendor technology can already do. But we make the existing vendor technology work for apps that you don't know about at design time, so just general applications. And so to do this, we leverage the app deployment model on mobile devices, which is basically through a third-party store. There's an intermediary that sits between the developers and the users that we can leverage to actually perform the needed computation in order to make this general. So what this looks like is we introduce a cloud compiler component to the app store, which we call Cloud RTR. And then this splits out between three different parties of the users, the developers, and the manufacturers. And so what is going to happen is manufacturers are going to upload their designs for what is going to be running on their devices, which is called a static design, which includes the definition of slots and things that don't change. And then what a user is going to see is they're just going to download an app, how they normally do. We have tooling inside the operating system that manages the FPGA on their behalf. But what developers are going to do is they're going to develop their apps the same way, but they're also going to upload some hardware definition written to C. And then the cloud compiler system will combine this and the static designs to make it so that the hardware definitions go to the right devices. So basically, static design consists of things that don't change, such as a GPU and necessary connections, such as an AXE interface, which is needed to connect things, and as well as the reserved areas for the slots. And this is what is sent to the cloud compiler. The developer creates their app using existing tools such as Android Studio, but they create their definition of hardware using C. And this will be generated into Verilog by the cloud compiler. And so what this is going to look like is they're basically going to implement a function that has been published by the, or a function header that has been published by the manufacturers. It's a simple C function, basically. It just has some arguments that are going to be standardized across the manufacturers. And finally, what happens in the cloud is the cloud is going to compile all this hardware for each app and for each different device and for each different slot in each variant. So basically, we have a number of different static designs, and each of these has slot definitions inside. We get an app. What it's going to spit out is basically a compiled hardware for each one of these different slots. And what the user sees is basically they download their app, and a system service is going to manage these slots. And so the download app is going to include their slot hardware. It's basically going to include these different compiled hardware modules. And the system is just going to load stuff into an available slot when their application is run. So that's basically how the system works. But there is one other thing that needs to be talked about, and there is some security considerations when using an FPGA. As I mentioned before, the FPGA has access to has direct memory access and can access a whole bunch of other things that are generally sensitive. So we also have a service that can enforce access. So in the operating system, the slot manager enforces access just basically using basic Linux permissions. But still on the hardware side, we have another system that prevents hardware being loaded to bypass these restrictions. We call this a secure loading service system that basically provides this. So I'm just going to step through how this works really quickly. Basically, I have in my chip, I have a processor and FPGA. What I'm also going to have is a memory controller and other peripherals, but we're just going to stick with memory for now, and the operating system, and there's some interconnects. So both the processor and the FPGA are able to access the memory controller. In the FPGA, I'm going to have some slots, but what I'm also going to have is my secure loading system, which consists of a signature verification module and then a module that actually performs the reconfiguration. And it does this using a tool called the ICAP, which is the internal configuration access port of the FPGA. It's basically a system that allows the FPGA to reconfigure itself. So what we do is we're going to only allow reconfigurations from inside the FPGA. The processor is going to be cut off from being able to do this. So when I want to load a slot into or a hardware into slot one, basically the operating system is going to send a signed module to the signature verification service. And if it passes verification, then it is going to be passed into the ICAP, and that will actually place it into slot one. So this only needs to happen for slot one because slot one is the only one that is configured to access a sensitive resource. If something is going to some other slot, it doesn't necessarily have to pass a signature verification check. So now that we have that, I want to go into our evaluation of our system. So basically, we acknowledge that there's already been general acceptance that hardware it can be faster than software in a lot of cases. What we want to talk about here is whether or not our system imposes some sort of high overhead that makes this no longer true in our case. So basically, we want to see, is there a value in our apps with hardware, and is our cloud compilation system practical? So to do this, we created a number of micro benchmarks to evaluate the first point. For example, we created a QAMD modulator, which is quadrature amplitude modulation, is a modulation scheme used in a lot of signal processing, such as sending television signals. So it represents an SDR application is what we're going for. And so from this, on the bottom line is basically how long it takes the FPGA to run for a certain number of samples, and the top line is how long it takes an equivalent software application to run. And so from this, we get a four orders of magnitude speed up by running it in the hardware, which is to be expected. And this was run using an Android app that called into the FPGA. And so a more complicated example we did was for cryptography. And so we created an AES module that basically can encrypt continuous 16-byte segments. And so we tested this a number of different ways. And so we're going top to bottom on this graph. We have first the using an Android app using the built-in AES function that is available in the AOSP for Java. The second line, the green line, is if we were to instead use an Android, or if the green line is if we were to run OpenSSL from the Android command line. The red line is if we were to call the FPGA using an Android app, but generating the data in Java and passing it to the FPGA using the Java native interface. And the bottom line is if we were to call the FPGA from the command line. So there's a problem here in that the red line and the red line is higher than the green line for a lot of this graph. The problem is that if you are passing stuff into the FPGA from Java, there's a lot of overhead in the memory transfer, which totally dwarfs the actual time it takes to do the computation. A solution for this is what we want to do is, in future work, do this at using Java native byte buffers so that we don't have to do this memory copying. But the bottom line is using the FPGA from inside Android, and we still get about a 3x speed up just using the most optimized version of OpenSSL we can get to run on Android. And finally, we did another sort of micro benchmark. We created a memory scanner, and what this can do is it can scan the entire system address space without the operating system being involved. So you just run it, and it just looks for a static string throughout the operating system without any interaction from software. And basically, it can do this with just a slight degradation of memory access. So 2.7% reduction in memory reads and a 5.5% reduction in writes. And this is with it just going through the entire system address space constantly. And we tested this using the LM test bench, which some of you might be familiar with. So now we also have to talk about our compilation in the cloud. So basically what we're doing is a brute force compilation across all the different slots. And so to estimate this for a larger ecosystem, we projected the number of apps that will likely be uploaded in January 2016, which was at the time of writing, from some data that was provided from AppFigures. And this gets us about 120,000 apps per month, projected from the average month growth of 2014. And so what we have here is what we did is we tested how long it takes to perform a compilation for a certain number of slots using our test hardware, which was an Intel server with at 2.1 gigahertz and 6 cores. So on the left is the number of slots and how many apps we can compile in a day for that number of slots. And then on the right is how many servers needed to meet a certain number of uploaded apps per month, so 0.1%, 1%, or 10%, and the possible number of device variance from 1 to 1,000. So for this graph, chart is for 121 apps per day. And so the highlighted blue is what I would consider reasonable for most scenarios. I don't think it's likely that 10% of all apps uploaded to the store are going to require new compilation and that there will be 1,000 number of device variants. So for a lower number of apps, especially to start out with, the number of servers that we need is fairly reasonable, going up to 29. I think that a large cloud service could provide this. Now, if I bump this number up to, say, only 51 apps per day, then the numbers get bigger, obviously. Now I need 69 servers, and this is starting to push the boundaries, but I still think it's somewhat reasonable. But again, this is in a worst case, in case everything needs to be recompiled on every upload, and that with a large number of uploads per month. So to reduce the numbers, there's a lot of things that can be done. First, if the compilation resources are too high, we can just offload to the manufacturers. But we find that it's likely that manufacturers will reuse their designs, just like most phones reuse Qualcomm chips or ARM chips when they're redesigning. There's not really much reason to have a different design if you're using the same chip from the same manufacturer. And we also think that developers are likely to use libraries. There's not much reason for a developer to, say, have another AES module if one already has been compiled. If one already exists, we don't need to recompile it when they upload it. They can just call to it. And so finally, what I want to talk about is we did an implementation case study using the Orbot Tor client for Android. So basically, this allows you to access Tor from Android along with a web browser. So we chose this because AES has been identified as being on the critical path for Android by the developers. But we only want to examine AES as an integration study of what needs to be done to port a complex existing app to use our system. And so when we did this, what we found is basically memory operations are the bottleneck. And there's a number of reasons why. Basically, you have to place data into a very specific area of your system memory in order for the FPGA to be able to read it while your software is able to read it. But the problem is that in order to do this, we currently use user space I/O, which has a very high overhead compared to doing just a standard malloc of memory. And what this leads to is a lot of system calls are also incompatible with using UIO, such as memset or memcopy, which also leads you then to have to re-implement those in software. So basically, it's easier to build an application from the ground up, But if we had something in the kernel to do this for us, we would it would improve the numbers a lot better and make this a lot more practical. So in conclusion, basically, we have presented our apps, our vision of apps with hardware. And this is done using Cloud RTR, which implements our vision by leveraging the mobile app deployments. And we believe we have demonstrated the value and practicality of our vision. So with that, I will take questions.
Hi, Dan Williams, IBM Research. So it seems like there, I don't know if this is right, but it seems like there's a trend for specialized, more specialized processors on these mobile devices. So like, you know, you may have maybe an AES coprocessor or something. Can you speak to whether that's true or if you think that it's all going to the FPGA space like you outlined, or if you think there'll be some of these specific set that's pretty common?
I can't exactly speak to that. If I were to conjecture, I say that you are right, but I think there's room for both. So things that exist now, like, you know, your specialized coprocessors or like AES just exists as an instruction in ARM now. There are things that everyone will need that would probably be best to make into just a hard peripheral. But if an application just needs one specific thing and no one else needs it, it doesn't make much sense to put it as a hard peripheral, but you can put it into the FPGA just as easily. And there are things the FPGA cannot do or can do that you can't do just by putting a hard peripheral everywhere.
Great.
Hi, Yunqi from University of Michigan. Very nice talk and a very interesting topic. I have two questions. The first one is related to how I actually deploy the app when user download the app from the App Store. If I understand correctly, you're basically asking the user to download from not only the app, the mobile app, but you also download the synthesized bitstream from the cloud, from the store. And I was wondering, where are you going to store these bitstreams at runtime? Because it seems like there will be a lot of different bitstreams. Imagining you have 10 apps, and you have like 10 different slots, you have to have like 100 different bitstreams yet available at runtime.
You're right. So we haven't looked a huge amount into this, but there is some numbers in the paper that I don't quite recall off the top of my head. But so a bitstream to, say, reconfigure, like a bitstream to reconfigure the entire FPGA is about 4 megabytes.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, the Orbot application, I believe, was around 30. And so a partial bitstream, something to just reconfigure a slot, is a lot smaller. It's about 2 megabytes. So, yeah, there is going to be an increase, especially if you have a lot of slots.
Mm-hmm.
How we distribute these is we include them as a resource inside of the APK. But if this takes off, there's probably going to be something else we need to do. But I think that for now, like, the resource overhead is not that great.
Okay, cool. So my second question is related to how you do like context switch on your mobile phone, because I'm running a lot of apps on my phone, but in order to do that context switch on FPGA, you basically have to reprogram on the slot. But if you do reprogram on the FPGA, you pretty much lose the program state on the slot you're reconfiguring. Do you have any?
Yeah, so you are absolutely correct that is what will happen. In the paper, we go into more depth about this.
Mm-hmm.
So what the manager inside the operating system can do is it can create virtual slots by time slicing the FPGA. The problem is that to reconfigure something is on the order of milliseconds, whereas a context switch is on the order of microseconds. And so there are a number of options that we can do to support this. One is we can have certain types of, you can define your app hardware module as something that it's not unsafe to unload while it's running, or it can be unloaded using like a callback function, or it is completely stateless.
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be a limit of certain things that can't be unloaded ever. There is, if you're going to be doing this a lot of context switching, there is kind of just an inherent problem with the FPGA.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as state, there are things that you can do with the FPGA to pull that out. I haven't explored those completely, but it's basically there's a capability called readback that you can do to pull out the state of both the memory and what's in the FPGA currently running.
Mm-hmm.
That we would like to explore for context switching.
Makes sense. Thank you.
Peter Fonseca, University of Washington. So it's really nice that you got the performance benefit with this approach. In mobile devices, it's also important, the energy consumption. So I wonder whether the performance benefits that you see with this approach also translate into benefits in terms of the energy consumption, basically.
So there is a lot of potential for research. This, our paper did not focus on power. We would like to go into that in future work. The problem with power is picking the right thing to optimize. So when you're, what the vendors will tell you is that when you have an FPGA, you get a lot better performance per watt. So having an FPGA running will increase your power usage versus not having the FPGA there. That's clear. What remains to be seen is offloading stuff into the FPGA. Can we do stuff with the CPU to then reduce that power consumption? Because the FPGA can do it faster, or maybe there's some other way to like turn the CPU off. Things like Somnilic we did. We did not explore that in this paper, unfortunately, but we would like to go into that going forward.
Okay, cool.
Okay, thank you, Michael.